presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine, with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with Jack Schneider, who's just released a solo album, Streets of September, and plays with Vince Gill. In our conversation, Jack tells us about his time in college at NYU at the Clive Davis School of Music and his connection to New York City. Jack talks about his time in Georgia and a high school class that ultimately led him to meet and develop a friendship with George Groon, who eventually gave Jack a job documenting a guitar collection that most of which ended up at Belmont University. Jack describes how George Groon introduced him to Vince Gill and how that led to a friendship, a job as a guitar tech, which in turn led to Jack's gig playing acoustic guitar in Vince's band. Jack talks about his personal guitar collection, which includes a lot of vintage guitars, including a 1952 Gibson Les Paul Gold Top and a 1952 Gibson Southern Jumbo. Jack takes us through his recordings and his recent album, Streets of September, as well as his session work and production of others. Jack tells us about his upcoming tour opening for Tommy Emmanuel and potential tours after that. To find out more about Jack, you can go to his website, jackschneidermusic.com. That's jackschneidermusic.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my buddy Jack.
Hey, I'm Jack.
I know.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Nice to meet you as well. Are you in Nashville right now?
I am. I'm home.
Oh, good. It looks rustic wherever you are.
I live in a cabin. I'm out in North Englewood in East Nashville. I'm on a bunch of land. It's really peaceful out here. Yeah.
There's a Clive Davis School of Music at NYU?
There is.
Is it recent or has it been there for a while?
I went in 2015, and I want to say that I was within the first 10 years of its creation.
Okay.
So relatively recent. Clive gave a bunch of money to the program because the music industry was evolving so rapidly that he wanted there to be a program that was about the history specifically of recorded music.
Okay.
Of the recorded music. So it was a really incredible context to have been given for music and all of the things that we create.
Sure. Did you graduate from there?
I did. I graduated in 2019, the year before the pandemic.
Yeah. Was this, you specifically wanted to go to NYU, or were there other colleges that you were looking at?
Well, to be totally honest with you, I always knew I wanted to make music and have a life in the creation of music. My parents really wanted me to go to college.
Sure. Yeah.
And NYU was a place that I was really impressed by. I didn't think that I was either going to get in or be able to afford it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As the fates allowed, I ended up being given enough scholarship to be able to go there.
Right on.
And I was accepted there, which I didn't think was going to happen. And so I felt like, okay, well, this is a really incredible opportunity. Let's see what there is to be learned while I'm here. And so there was sort of always the plan of wanting to be in the space of creating music, but I'm really grateful to have had that time to have been in a college environment, be in New York City, and be able to soak it all up and learn and transmute the things that I experienced into my path as a songwriter and a creative individual.
Yeah. Were there other colleges you were looking at?
Belmont was a place that I was interested in because I knew early on that I wanted to live in Nashville even before I went to New York. So there's part of me that was curious about going to a school here where I could sort of start living here a little early. I'd applied to USC in California.
Oh, really?
I have so many wonderful friends that live in LA, but it's a place that's never felt quite like home to me. I enjoy visiting there, but I didn't feel comfortable with the idea of living in LA for 4 years. So
good for you.
That was sort of a reasoning against that. But again, I think LA is a great place. It didn't feel aligned with what I was looking for spiritually.
Sure. I totally understand. Had you been to New York before that?
I had. So my mom was born and raised in New York. She's from Long Island. And she and my dad were actually living in New York when I was born.
Okay.
I was their first kid, and they had me when they were living in a studio apartment that had the kitchen and the bathroom were the same room.
Yeah.
And so they're like, you know, this is probably not exactly going to work out for having a family. So my dad got a job in Atlanta, Georgia, and they moved me down there when I was about, I want to say, 1 or 2 years old. But so because they had lived there, though, a lot of our family trips growing up, we're going back to see their friends in New York, to see their family in New York. So New York always was a place I felt comfortable in, a place that I felt home within.
And what part of Atlanta did you live in?
I grew up in the Marietta Vinings area and lived there until I went to school in New York.
Okay. Wow. Right on. Yeah. Had you visited Nashville before you came out to Nashville?
So I visited, the story about Nashville for me is that I was in a class in high school, in my freshman year of high school, called The History of American Roots Music. And it was with a teacher called, his name was Dr. Barksdale. And we watched a documentary about Bill Monroe and the creation of bluegrass music. And in this documentary, there was an interview with a man named George Groon. And I was so just, he was such a wealth of knowledge watching him in this documentary. I was like, I want to meet this person. I want to be able to talk to this person. Yeah. And so I begged my parents. I said, hey, Groon Guitars, that's in Nashville. That's 3.5 hours away. I just want to go for 2 days. Let me go for 2 days. And so my freshman year of high school, they drove me to Nashville straight to Groon Guitars.
Oh, wow.
Literally. Door to door. And I went in and I was a young scrawny kid or whatever. And I said, hey, is you know, Mr. Groon here? And they said, yes, it is. And so he came down to meet me and we just immediately connected. And so George was sort of this portal for me into being immersed in the space of Nashville, the community here. And I owe it all to him because he said, you know, I knew when I met you, you connected dots in a way that most people I've met don't. And so we just really connected. And that was, so to answer your question, that was how I came to Nashville, was really just to connect with this person. And then through his generosity of spirit and his wealth of knowledge, I've just sort of been on this journey, this path. Of, doors just continuing to open.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful that somebody as legendary as George would have seen something in me and taken me under his wing and created kindness for me that he didn't have to do.
Yeah.
I recognize the privilege that I have in that position.
Yeah. And what was your knowledge of vintage guitars like before you met George?
You know, great question, because I read about them a lot. I've always been somebody interested in history, right? So I was really interested in the history of the acoustic guitar. I played guitar my whole life, started playing when I was 3 years old.
And
understanding that steel string guitar is sort of a newer innovation that only really happened in the 1920s. And I love the history in context of the music that spoke to me, right? How Bill Monroe was influenced by a particular mandolin that had a long scale and that gave it the signature chop. I really liked the connection of the music to the instruments.
Yeah.
And that being said, I'd never gotten a chance to play any old instruments. I grew up in Atlanta. There wasn't really a vintage guitar community around where I was. I had a beginner Alvarez guitar that I spent $329 on when I was 9 years old. I'd never played a herringbone D28. I'd never played a 1952 Les Paul or a 1954 Stratocaster. I knew about them, but I never played them. So when I came to Groon Guitars and I met George, it was this opportunity to actually understand what these instruments did and how they were different from each other, what made them unique. And George ended up giving me my first job when I was in college. I was, like I said, I was on scholarship, but I needed some money because New York is ridiculously expensive.
Sure.
And George said, why don't you come to Nashville in the summer and work for me? I'll pay you. We'll find a job for you.
Yeah.
And the job I ended up having was to archive and catalog a collection of 500 instruments that a man had left behind in his will to be turned into a museum.
Oh, wow.
I had this very rare opportunity to spend 2 months with 75 herringbones.
Wow.
6 pre-war D-45s. Wow. I got to hold them. I got to play them. And I got to understand how these instruments, you know, just because it's a herringbone doesn't mean it spoke to me. Or just that it, because it was a D-45, didn't mean it spoke to me. And really understanding, yes, they're historic. Yes, they are these, you know, vessels of energy, but they're also very personal. It's wire and wood, and the wood was once a tree, and the energy of something that's living, energy is neither created nor destroyed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So really getting to spend time with these instruments taught me a lot about playing music. So it was an incredible opportunity to hone my skills as a player through the exposure to what I would consider some of the greatest instruments ever made.
Yeah. Were these instruments, were they in a warehouse, or were they actually in the shop?
They were all in the third floor of George's shop. And it was like a whole wall of cases, three levels high, and you just pull a case down, open it up, and there'd be a D-45.
Yeah.
You'd pull a case down, open it up, there'd be a Banner J-45. You'd pull a case open, and you didn't know what you would see. And I mean, it was truly one of the greatest learning experiences
sure.
I could have ever dreamed of.
Yeah, yeah. Were they mostly acoustics, or were some electrics as well?
I'd say it was 70% acoustic, 30% electric. The electrics that were there were two bursts.
Oh, wow.
There were a few gold tops, a lot of Strats and a lot of Tellys, not a lot of Gibsons.
Uh-huh.
The electrics that were there were mostly Blackguards and 50s Stratocasters.
Yeah.
There may have been a handful of slabboard Strats as well. But
and did they actually end up in a museum, or how many ended up with Tom Bukovac? How many ended up with Tom Bukovac?
That's hilarious, man. Man, I love Luke. I've been really fortunate to have gotten to know him through my work with Vince, and he's one of my favorite people on the planet. I don't know that he ended up with any from that collection. What did happen was, there were 500, and the ones that wound up in the museum were the ones that were really, really pristine and collector grade. There were a lot of things in the collection that were, you know, a pre-war D-28, but that had a lot of top cracks or had a refinished back. And so things like that ended up getting sold to fund the museum itself, the upkeep of the collectible instruments. I actually wound up with two of the instruments from that collection myself, with a 1952 Southern Jumbo.
Wow.
Gibson acoustic.
Yeah.
And I wound up with the 1952 Les Paul.
Oh, right.
And it's really interesting because they're almost the same guitar.
Uh-huh.
It's the same neck, it's the same scale length. The 52 Les Paul is, in all intents and purposes, an acoustic guitar with pickups on it. It responds like an acoustic guitar. The neck angle, being a little shallower, is like an acoustic guitar. And when I play shows, sometimes I bring those guitars, and it's almost interchangeable.
Wow.
For me, going from the electric to the acoustic, same year, same neck, same sort of, you know, energy of wood and construction. I don't know if Uncle Larry ended up with anything from that collection. I do know there are a few instruments, and I know where they wound up, but I don't know if he ended up with anything from there.
Yeah. And then what is the museum where these ended up?
Museum ended up at Belmont. It's in their library. Okay. Forgive me, I don't remember what they eventually called it. That happened after my blogging had been done.
Yeah.
It was an incredible learning experience. And there is a museum at Belmont that's in their library, and you can go and see. I mean, there's a pre-war D-45. There's a Lore Quartet. I mean, there's some really special stuff that's there.
Yeah. So, I mean, is as simple as Vince Gill walks into Grunes and you happen to be playing and he hires you?
Well, not quite. You know, when I met George, I was 15 years old, and he told me at the time, he said, you know, you remind me a lot of somebody that I met when they were your age.
Uh-huh.
I would really love to introduce you. And I didn't know who that was that he was talking about. A few years went by, and eventually that meeting did happen, and I found out that it was Vince. And Vince is a childhood hero of mine.
Sure.
I love listening to his records.
Yeah.
And it was such an honor to become acquainted with this person. I mean, truly, I mean, I was, you know, a young kid, and I was really nervous around him. And he treats people, he treats everybody on the same plane with kindness and respect. I mean, truly, he has no ego.
Yeah.
And every time I would come to Nashville, I would call him really nervously and say, hey, Mr. Gill, it's Jack. You know, I'm in town just for a few days. If you have any time, it would be great to get together. But if you don't, no worries. And he would always make time to see me, whether it was for breakfast or inviting me to a show that he was doing or the Bluebird Cafe.
Yeah.
He always opened the door. And then over time, you know, there was a Bluebird Cafe round that he was doing, and he brought me as his guest. And the round went, you know, a few times. And he's like, you know, this young kid that's here that I've gotten to know. And, you know, I thought, he's never played the Bluebird before. Why don't we bring him up? And I didn't know that this was happening. And he brings me up and I play a song. And so slowly over time, he sort of, you know, gave me these little moments to be myself and play either my own music or in some cases to play guitar with him. And he gave me a lot of advice and sort of gave me all of the pieces, all of the tools.
Sure,
and
then,
you know, a little bit over time, I kept putting the pieces together. And as the opportunity showed up, I tried to make sure that I would be ready.
Yeah.
And the first time I worked for him was the year right after I got out of college. I was really broke and I'd had a near-death experience that wound up with me having a lot of medical debt.
Sure.
And he ended up giving me the opportunity to be a guitar tech in his band.
Oh, right on.
Hey, you know, we have an opening. He's like, I know you want to be a musician. I know you want to play guitar. I don't want you to be offended by this, but we do need somebody to do this job, and it would be a chance for you to get some experience on the road and make some money. Would you want to do it? I said, absolutely. I'll do it. I'll learn. And so I did it. And getting to have that experience, I was backstage every night listening to the show, and I would learn the songs.
Yeah.
I'd learn the songs. And then a couple of years went by, and then Jeff White, who has long been in the band, somebody that I respect a great deal. He was out in Lyle Lovett's band for that summer tour, and Book was unavailable. So Jed ended up playing electric guitar, and Vince needed somebody to play acoustic. And he just said, hey, Jack, would you want to come do this? I was like, oh my God. Yeah. And so that's how it happened, you know, like a little bit over time. And I just, I truly can't believe that it really is real.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I grew up in his records.
Were you singing harmonies as well, or just playing guitar?
I was not above, below.
Okay.
I didn't quite get up above it.
Were your parents musical early on?
No,
I
was the only one in my family, except for my grandmother, who has since passed away, rest in peace. She was a music psychologist, so
okay.
Always very sympathetic to the idea that music was healing for the creator and for the person receiving the energy of the music. And she was, even though we didn't play music together, she was very encouraging of my pursuit in and around it. My parents are wonderful people, but they having a career in the music industry was like going to the circus to them, you know? And they've always been really supportive, and I've had to just sort of, you know, tell them, hey, it's okay. Trust me. Yeah. I'm figuring this out one day at a time. And ultimately, the reality is that I'd rather be happy than rich.
Oh, yeah.
And
of course.
I get to play music every day, to wake up and be in the space of music and get to connect with people through music.
Yeah.
I feel like the wealthiest person on the planet to be surrounded by so many great musicians who I can learn so much from.
Yeah. How did you come to acquire a guitar at the age of 3?
Well, my mom did have a guitar. Okay. So she wanted to learn how to play lullabies to me. And that never, but it was there in this music stand, or the guitar stand. And I would just go and I'd play it like in this. There's pictures of me like playing this guitar on the stand. And eventually, like, you know, she found a really wonderful person at a guitar store in Atlanta called Maple Street Guitars. And there was a man there named Charles Williams, and she called him when I was 4. She's like, hey, I've got a 4-year-old that likes playing guitar. Would you give him a lesson? Don't hang up. And like, Sure, bring him by. And the lessons were really just him instilling the passion in me, not teaching me, you know, scales or sure. notes. It was just like, you know, what do you like about music? And we'd have, it was more philosophical than anything, yeah. but I never feel like I practiced a day in my life because it was always just the joy of getting to make music. My parents got me a toy guitar when I was probably 4 or 5. And then when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, I realized I needed to have a steel string guitar. And that's when I saved up $329 for that first Alvarez that I had.
Right on.
Yeah. I still have.
Yeah, he's still have. So how do you go from being Vince Gill's acoustic guitar player to having your own record deal?
Well, I should say I don't have my own record deal. Okay. I'm fully independent. And
right on.
That's largely by choice. Uh-huh. What really happened was getting to have all this experience with Vince and being on stage and realizing that, you know, I love all of it, right? I love producing people's records. I love playing on people's records. I love playing shows, accompanying other people. But there's also something really spiritual to me about bringing people together mm-hmm. and creating an experience of collective healing.
Yep.
We all need presence more than ever in a world that is run by artificial intelligence and screens and to be able to be together in a room, breathing and experiencing a story is really important to me. What's also really important to me that I've realized is that I grew up on a lot of the 70s singer-songwriters like yep. Jim Croce, Gordon Lightfoot, and James Taylor.
Sure, sure.
And there are a lot of people of my generation that don't know those songs.
Yeah.
That have never heard
time. For before. Sure.
And so there, it's sort of all of these pieces connected in my brain, which is that it's not that I'm in the pursuit of fame or success in the traditional sense. It's that I feel called to preserve the songs that made it so that I am in the space of music. Yeah. I want to be able to do that so that other people can be exposed to this great music. And that's why when I play my own shows, when I make my own records, it's usually about half of my own songs, uh-huh. but half of the songs are songs that I want to see continue to live and be sentient sure. in the world. And so the way that I see all of it is none of it's instead of, it's all in addition to. I still play with Vince. I still produce other people's records. And
wow.
it's why I've chosen to stay independent is because it gives me the creative freedom uh-huh. to be able to be in the pursuit of the things that matter to me. And, you know, it's worked so far, and I'm really excited about having this music out in the world. I'm also in the process of making another record that'll come out in the spring. Wow. I'm getting ready to go on tour opening for one of my heroes, Tommy Emmanuel. Yeah. I'm doing about a month's worth of shows with him, I believe. And I'm putting a record together of songs that will align with what that experience is going to be as far as me and an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
I've got most of the songs written, and so next month is when I'm probably going to start putting them on tape.
Right on. Excellent.
Yeah.
And so the guitars that you played on the album, is it a wealth of guitars, or is it mostly those?
Wealth of guitars.
Okay.
The record was a serendipitous experience. I was actually, the studio was booked, and the musicians were booked for a friend that I was going to produce a record for. So all of these pieces were in place. All these guitars were borrowed and everything was there. And then at the last minute, he realized that it was a lot for him to sort of get around to doing. And he decided to bail. And I, you know, I felt a lot of guilt around canceling on these people that were something to do a favor for me. Right.
Sure.
And so I talked to the engineer on the session, who's my friend, Matt Andrews. And I said, hey, if I wanted to take these sessions and just do something for myself, would you feel comfortable stepping out of the engineer role and also being the producer? And he said, absolutely. I'd be honored. And so we went through a bunch of songs that I'd sort of had and scraped these sessions together like 3 weeks before they started. But there was a wealth of guitars that had been borrowed. And so I'll tell you what, there was a 1937 Martin Singolo 21.
Wow.
There was a 1964 Epiphone Texan that is a high strung. So it's the octave set from a 12 string. That was the high strung. There was a 1961 Guild F50. That was my first vintage guitar.
Wow.
There was the electric guitar was a, it's my 1952 Les Paul Gold Top.
Yep.
There's also a black Les Paul custom three pickup that's on the solo of Stone's Throw Away. And that was a guitar that was Vince's had been Nashville flood and the whole guitar got destroyed. And the finish ended up being totally okay, but all the electronics got, you know, wiped out. And so I put all the electronics in it and brought it back to life. And that's a great guitar. There was a dreadnought on a lot of the acoustic stuff that was made by a builder named Carlo Greco, who I actually got to know shortly before he passed away.
Oh, wow.
A handmade guitar that's a rosewood dreadnought pearl top. And that was one of my first really special guitars that I came into possession of. I'm trying to think what else would have been used on it. There was a 43 Herringbone D28 on Gulf of Mexico. Wow. I'm thinking through the song.
I think that may
be it. Oh, there was a 1965 Guild D40 also that was used in a open tuning a open D, and that's on How in the World and Renee. It's that guitar.
Yeah. Well, it's a lovely album. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course. I do hear. I mean, you can't help but hear some of those 70s influences there. And
that was intentional. You know, we did it at a studio called Burns Sound in Burns, Tennessee. And it's an old studio from the mid 70s that's been kept going. And we recorded it through their analog console, through a tape machine. And the record was mostly done the process of how those records were done in the 70s, which was really to preserve the stories. All of these songs are stories.
Yeah.
The record that I recorded what that week was coincided with the 5-year anniversary of this near-death experience that I had. Okay. And all of these songs ended up being connected to transmuting my grief and sense of suffering from that experience into something that allowed for my own internal healing. Sure. And so it was recorded to sort of function as a story, right? Which to me, when I listen to Tapestry or Sweet Baby James or Souvenirs by Dan Fogelberg, like these are records that were the heart of these people.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all about being transparent, right?
Uh-huh.
The sound of the records, the playing, the arrangements. It was how can we get out of the way of the song? Not a lot of reverb, not a lot of effect, right? Like really dry and really focused on the narrative of the stories. And that was our approach. So I feel it is a compliment to me that you would hear the connection in that record to some of those influences that I have. So thank you for saying that.
Of course. How do you end up on tour with Tommy Emmanuel?
Well, that is something that was a gift from a booking agent that I've worked with for the last few years who he's no longer has the capacity to be working with me. He's I think approaching the part of his life where he's transitioning and lightening his workload. And before that happened, he said, I really want to come through for you and give you something to roll with. And he asked Tommy about just a few dates, as far as I know. And this is just what was relayed to me. So I don't want to speak a false truth, but my understanding was that, you know, he asked Tommy about me doing just, you know, a handful of dates, but I've gotten to know Tommy through Vince and through playing the Grand Ole Opry. And when Tommy heard that it was me that was being pitched, he offered to have me do the whole tour and come with him on the bus and play a couple songs in his show with him, I believe, which I'm really nervous about. But such a gift. And I'm grateful. I want to say a huge thanks to Bobby Cudd for believing in me and for just wanting to make things happen. I truly, like I said, feel like the luckiest person on the planet to be given such gifts of opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, right on. You mentioned that you're working on a new album that's sort of coinciding with this. Are you going to do your own tour after done with Tommy?
I don't know. Hopefully. You know, I've always been somebody that sort of goes where the wind blows.
Sure.
And so I it's hard for me to predict the future. I would love to. I think my hope is that I find a small but loyal audience of people that want to come into a small room and experience music and, you know, an hour of something real and share in a healing experience. And I really do fundamentally believe that there is an audience out there that wants that. And, you know, I'm doing all of these things to, you know, you see if that audience presents itself. Sure. Right. And so the hope is that there are enough people that would want to come out and see those shows. Yeah. And if there are, I would be so honored to do them, bring these songs to cities around the country, around the world. Yeah. But if that doesn't happen, I also get so much joy out of playing in other people's bands and helping people with their records that, you know, it, to me, the future is just a big question mark. And I think, I think it's best when you accept it in those terms, at least to me. If I can surrender and say, hey, today's the only thing that's real for me. Tomorrow is not real yet. Yeah. It keeps me focused and present. And I get to be present with somebody like you and we get to have this real moment together. And it's beautiful, you know?
How often do you go by Grunes?
Oh, I try to go there like, you know, whenever I'm home, I try to go, you know, so if I'm home for a couple of weeks, I'll go. I went there on, I was there on Saturday. So okay. I was there and George is still one of my really good friends. I see him at the Opry a lot backstage.
Oh, okay.
And he also, I had a show at the station in last night and he came down. It was great to have him there.
Right, so on.
I stay really close to George. This year, a lot of my personal, you know, finances have been tied up in record making.
Oh yeah.
I had to sort of cut off the tap of buying instruments.
Yeah.
It's like, there's so many instruments I want to get. And, you know, I love all of the people at Grunes, but it's a little bit dangerous for me to, you know, go in there and, oh my, what's that instrument?
Yeah.
I have to have that. You know, that's happened more times than I care to admit. So I have to be a little bit cautious about where I go and when I go.
Yeah. What does your personal collection, apart from the two that you've already mentioned, what does your personal collection look like?
It's really lucky with what has presented itself. A lot of these instruments were things that were either gifts or things that a person contacted me about and wanted me to have for a very reasonable price. I'm not inherently wealthy.
Yeah, yeah, no.
But, you know, I have some really, really lovely instruments. I have a 1956 Martin D28 that I bought from Gillian Welch. That's one of my favorite instruments. The 1965 Gill D40 was a gift from the folks at Retro Fret Guitars.
Oh, right on.
Fantastic shop. Great, great people.
Yeah.
And they gave that guitar to me because they knew that I loved it. And I use it all the time. My main acoustic guitar that I play out and that I write with was a gift to me. It was built by Mark Whitebook, who was a legendary acoustic guitar builder in the 70s. It's a mahogany dreadnought that he gave to me. I have a 1967 Martin D1220. I have that Southern Jumbo I told you about in the Les Pauls.
Yep.
I have a 1966 Gibson Everly Brothers model.
Oh yeah.
Which is a great rhythm guitar. That's my go-to rhythm guitar for sessions. I've got a 64 Guild M20, and a 1972 Guild F612 12 strings, like a big 18 inch, like massive 12 string that they only made, I think, a couple dozen of. I've got that Carlo Greco guitar I told you about.
Yeah.
I've got a couple gut strings. I've got a 1968 Guild Mark VI that I bought from the son of a rabbi on the street of Brooklyn.
Okay.
For $400. And then I have a guitar that used to belong to Harold Bradley, session guitar player.
Of course.
And it's a Hermanos Conde 1959 flamenco guitar. And it's what Harold played on the original recording of Love Hurts by Roy Orbison. And that's a guitar I write a lot of songs on. And whenever I play on somebody else's session, I always bring that guitar in just in the hopes that, you know, there might be a place for it. But I think that's about it. You know, I've got like a parts Telecaster that I put together myself and, you know, a parts Stratocaster that was a gift to me. But some really, really special instruments. Yeah, and
what do you have for an amp?
I have three amps. I have a 1959 Gibson Skylark.
Yeah.
One knob, really just awesome studio amp. And then I have a 65 Vibrochamp that I got from Dave Rawlings. That is it's my favorite trem that I've ever, the Vibro, crazy, crazy, crazy. That's what I used on the record is that one. And then a gift from Vince is one of those little Walters like he uses. Yeah. And it's a 50 watt head, and it's a two speaker. It's basically like a 2x12. It's like a twin cabinet with a 50 watt head.
Yeah.
It's so clean and open sounding, and Phil is just a brilliant mind. In many ways, it's like playing through, you know, just like playing through this speaker.
Yeah,
like doesn't really even feel like an amplifier. Yeah. It's like so clear and open and beautiful. But it sometimes is more sound than I need. So it's at this point mostly just for my own pleasure, playing around the house when I want to play really loud and crank it open and just let it bloom.
Yeah.
I've been some, or you know, when I'm singing in a band, or I played the Ryman a couple times, and that was the amp that I brought to use. And that's it, just those three amps. And then I have like a solid state Vox Pathfinder 15R, which is an amp I bought for $50 at a pawn shop, and it's an amp I use more often than I care to admit. It's just, you know, there's something about those particular amps that are usable and they're cheap. And so if I have a gig and I want to leave the amp in a car and not worry about it.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that's what I'll usually grab for.
Yeah. How much of your time is spent doing session work and or production work?
Depends on the season, to be honest. You know, I've been really fortunate to have started producing a traditional country record on an artist named Abby Cohn. Okay. And we worked on it really heavily in the winter. And then I sort of shifted gears to my record, and I've been sort of mostly doing my own work, you know, the last several months, but I really missed the session work. I did a few sessions this week, actually. And then I've got some sessions this weekend. I would say I don't really like to say no to things, to be honest. I'm a people pleaser to a fault, and I love to say yes. And so I'll say yes and figure out how to make it all work later. And that means there's some seasons where I don't really sleep much and I drink a lot of coffee. This winter, I know that things are going to be slowing down, and I'm going to mostly be focused on my own music. And then I know there's a bunch of Vince Opry's coming up. You know, it's the 100th anniversary of the Grand Ole Opry, which is amazing to celebrate that. And so I know we're playing it a bunch in October. So I'll probably be doing mostly that and then my record in October. And I think Abby and I are going to get back to her record probably in November and December. So, you know, it's sort of this perpetual balancing act.
Yeah.
All gifts in all different ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Jack. I really appreciate your time.
Oh my gosh, you too. And thank you for such great questions, for listening, for letting me tell my story.
Absolutely.
And I am really grateful that you've had me on your podcast.
Yeah. And you're coming out with Tommy, you're coming out in April of next year, and I hope to catch you then.
So I meant to ask you, and maybe I forgot, where are you located?
I'm in Napa, California, Northern California.
Okay, amazing. Is that...
You're doing a show in Sacramento, and that's like an hour and a half away from me. And then you're doing Santa Cruz. That's like a couple hours away from me. So,
okay, awesome. Well, please, I don't know if you have you've got my contact information. Please reach out, and it would be my honor to have you as my guest.
Oh, right on. Thank you.
If you want to come too?
Yeah, I do.
It'd be awesome to have you there.
Right on. Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, of course.
Have a great day.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay,
take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar, Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.